Ahoy, ahoy. Welcome to Head Game, the science and psychology of sports. Our guest today is Miriam Glez. Miriam is a four-time Olympian, twice as an athlete and twice as a coach, each trip representing four different countries, which is actually really impressive. She has extensive background in high performance management and athlete wellness, and she's recently created a nonprofit organization called Athlete Soul, which helps athletes with their transition out of sports and raises awareness about the challenges of athletic retirement. Miriam, welcome to Head Games.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
So I gave the tweet-sized version of your background, but tell us a little bit more about yourself. How did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from France. I was a synchronized swimmer for 20 plus years, 25 years. I competed for the French national team in the Sydney Olympics in 2000. Ended up retiring in 2002 to go to business school. Just before the Athens Olympics, I studied business. I started working for a hotel company, and then I moved with that hotel company to Australia, where I actually returned for the sport and competed for with the Australian team in the Beijing Games. So it was all by accident. And then I retired again, and my husband and I moved to England. I ended up working with the English team before London. And then we came back to the U.S. He's from the U.S. And so I started working for USS Synchronized Swimming. So I stayed in my sport. I started with some high performance management and eventually was the CEO for the organization. Then a couple of years back, I left, and one thing led to another. I started Athlete Soul, which is the nonprofit that you talked about before. So that's how I got here.
What a path! I don't know if this is true, but I can only imagine that you're one of the only, if very few, people to have gone to the Olympics four times with four different countries. Like, that's absolutely insane and extremely commendable, right? Most people can't even dream of making it once with one country, much less four times with four different countries. So kudos again to you on that.
Ask if this was in the Guinness World Record.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could try that.
That's so wild to hear kind of more about the path that you followed. What was it like to come back to the sport after that initial retirement and that kind of initial layoff?
First of all, it was absolutely not planned. It was really by accident. In the first retirement, I was asked by my federation and my coaches to choose between going to school and complete my business school or prepare for the Olympics. So that was a bittersweet retirement. I never thought I would go back. And there was just an opportunity to compete when I was in Australia. I ended up winning the national championship, and then they came back and asked if I was going to compete for them. And I received full support from my employer at the time. So I just decided to go back. So it wasn't really planned. And at that point, you know, it becomes a bonus, really. It's just like, take everything you can. You transform something that was pretty hard and rough transition because you didn't choose it, to be like, okay, now I've got these 2-3 years of bonus, and I better make the most of it. And it was a fantastic opportunity. The two coaches were from Russia and Ukraine, countries that were leading the sport at the time and still today. And so for me, it was like, oh my God, I've got this brilliant opportunity where not only I can compete for another country, but also, you know, be under the leadership of these coaches and learn everything I can from them, which, you know, I didn't have an opportunity like this before. So it was amazing.
Yeah. Well, did it feel different that second time around?
Oh, yeah. In different ways, your first Olympic Games still remains like your first Olympic Games. Mm. I mean, that for all the environment experience, I guess, right? The walking, in the ceremony, the village, like everything is new, especially when you've traveled, you know, 24 hours to go to the country. It's pretty special, and having it in Australia was pretty special. So I think you can't take that first time away. But that second experience is different in the sense that you've been there, you know how it's going to look like. It's more comfortable, you're more mature, you're not distracted by the environment. So the second time around, I think you're more focused on the performance for sure than you are in the first place. And then you start seeing those, also the cracks in the wall. Like, I remember in Beijing thinking, oh my God, the village is like a prison, you know, because there's so much security, there's so many fences around it. Where the first time you have sparkle in your eyes and it's like, yeah, this is awesome. So yeah, as you progress, you see different things.
Yeah. Wow. So can you tell us a little bit about the training program for synchronized swimming? Neither Brett nor I are big swimmers, certainly not synchronized swimmers. So can you tell us just a little bit about the training program, what it's like? I mean, we've seen some things, I think, more publicized about like gymnastics and figure skating and how ridiculous those regimens are. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to do that, because you're right, like not a lot of people know about synchronized swimming. So it's really nice to be able to dive into it. It's pretty much similar, I think, to gymnastic and figure skating in the sense of like it requires a lot of hours very early on. You know, typically the athlete starts really early at 5-6 years old. And by the time you're 10 years old, you're already training every day, multiple hours. And then when you get to the highest level, like when I was at the National Training Center and on the national team, you train 8-10 hours a day, 6 days a week. So it's very intense and time consuming. A lot of these hours are spent, depending on the season, obviously, but we do tons of different things. It's so varied. It starts from running to weightlifting to dance, plenty of gymnastics for lift and physical training, swimming, and then physical training in the water, and then working on routines. So there's a big variety to it. And, you know, at the beginning of the season, you would spend a great amount of time on creativity and choreographing routines. And then, you know, the middle of the season, you're really working on heavy endurance step to be able to maintain those routines. And then at the end of the season, it's more refining and detail on the routine themselves.
Speaking of choreography, a big theme on this podcast is usually team chemistry. It's a big area of research for myself, and Ben and I have collaborated a lot on this. And I think as spectators, we certainly see the choreography is really what speaks about synchronized swimming. It's not just two people moving in synchrony, but it feels sort of like there might be some chemistry to that. Could you maybe explain about how that works and sort of like the team level of work between either the pair or the team of people performing in synchronized swimming?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the two, because I think it's a very different type of work, whether you have the group of eight or the duet. In the duet, there's definitely a really heavy chemistry, in the sense that, well, I guess I have to backtrack a little bit. The part of the team element that our boss for the duet and the teams is really, you know, you're counting every beats on the music. You have a movement on every beat. And then you have to perform this upside down in a certain pattern, which will change. You know, we typically have about 25 different patterns for the whole routine. So you're performing your technical skills while sometimes spinning and changing patterns and trying to be in line with the other athletes. So all of this, I think, are part of the team chemistry. But in the pair, because there's just fewer people and you're swimming so closely together, you also have to like feel each other. A lot of it is just sensing that you're on the same rhythm and performing the same drills and synchronizing what happens on the water as well as what happened above water. So if your technique on the water is not accurate and you can tell that it's not synchronized with the other athlete, it will show above the water. And you're also trying to like learn to swim in the same way, which is really hard. Like, you know, imagine a football player or a baseball player trying to like get the same swing every time, the same way, exact same way as the other person, and the angle and everything. So that's what you're trying to get at some point is, and that takes years. That's why so many pairs are, they built in early ages with athletes that have, you know, similar body type, similar height, so similar weight, so that they can move the same way, or even similar bone density, so that they can be, you know, in the same height in the water. So in the pair, I think it's got a huge impact. And in the team, it's really important. And that aspect too of like having the same sort of cookie cutter type of body helps a team, you know, be better and more synchronized. But you also want to have, you know, a shorter athlete for the one who is jumping above water, the stronger one under the water. And then you'll have athletes that really bring the team together. And like sometimes you talk through the routine, even though like the spectators might not see it. Like someone might be talking and pushing everybody to at the end of the routine. So they are different aspects, and it's for sure absolutely a team sport. Perhaps not in the same way where you have a lot of strategy on game day. Our strategy on game day is to perform what we've learned for a year beforehand, right? But definitely in the practice and there's a lot of elements.
Well, it sounds very similar to sort of what we've heard and kind of, you know, for Ben and I, what we've studied. Number one, I think you mentioned like just sensing what's going on. And we've talked about this, that we've noticed in other sports as well, is that the team takes on this like greater entity. It's unto itself. And I think that idea of like sensing it is popular among other athletes describing that feeling of what it's like. And also you mentioned this idea of roles, that there are different people doing different things, that someone's getting, you know, someone's getting launched and somebody else is getting propped up, and there's, you know, there's different roles in terms of like who's being more social and who's stepping up as a leader. So I think that maps on exactly to other sports, which I think is
and part of this is the trust too in someone else, you know, playing their part so that you can play your part. Personally, I was a flyer, so I was the person that was doing the acrobatics above the water, and you know, you got to trust that the people under you are doing the right work, but yourself as well, you know, you need to know that you're going to deliver. And so that there's a high level of trust in that comes in as well.
Yep.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I mean, like Brett said, it aligns with a lot of the things that other athletes talk about from other sports. So really interesting to see the parallels. You touched on this a little bit, but can you talk a bit more about what it's like to work specifically in a duet with a partner and kind of some of the ins and outs of what that's like? Is there pressure? Do you put pressure on each other to win? What are some of the factors that go into that?
I think there are a lot of aspects. And one part that's interesting is often you have a star on a team, you know, like any other sport, and then you're trying to pair someone else with a star. And I think that brings a lot of challenges. But it's important to have the star because it's a judge sport. And so you want to have that recognition from the judges, someone who has been good as in the solo, for example, and has a name and is recognized is an asset for your pair. But then it brings some difficulty in like getting the other athletes to actually match that person. So, there are different strategies between countries. Like country will have a like the star and then someone added, or will have a true pair that really looks similar. That brings different aspects into working as a pair. But you know, some of the communication is a big element. Not just the sensing, but just to help in the day-to-day work, you need to really be able to communicate and be on the same page and looking for the same goals. I feel like it's more than two, because the way you work a pair with a coach, I mean, at the end of the day, it's really three people. So being able to have that triangle relationship, and triangular relationship are not always really easy to manage. So I think that aspect is quite interesting. We don't really want to have one athlete with the coach more than another athlete. So it's trying to find that balance in the work. And it's also, this event is so specific because you are way more involved in the creation, in the strategy. You're sort of like working really alongside the coach, where in the team, you know, you just more follow the strategy that the coach is putting on you for all the athletes. Hmm.
There's so many levels to this. Like you're talking about dynamics and early, and we're talking about the team levels and roles, and you're talking about training. And there's just, I mean, it sounds like for many professional athletes, it is your life. It is so timely. Mm-hmm. And when athletes come to their end of their career, I think maybe for us who aren't professional athletes, we can make guesses, but like, why is it hard for people to adjust? Why is it hard for professional athletes to adjust to life after, you know, that 9 to 5 of being professional? What do Olympians also specifically struggle with?
Well, there's so many different aspects, I think, that make the transition hard for any athlete. It depends on how you ended your career. You know, did you choose it or not? Obviously, sometimes if you don't choose, that's not an easy situation to come to terms with, or whether it's an injury, or whether you've been deselected, or your government chose for you not to participate. Mm-hmm. Or the training, the competition schedule changed and the pandemic came in and this is the end of your career. This can have really long lasting effects for people because they feel that they were not worthy enough, or they didn't reach the goal. They feel like failure or someone, you know, like there's a lot that can come to your mind. And because you transition at such a young age in life, I think it can have a pretty drastic imprint on what you're doing next. And so I think part of that, you know, has an impact on emotional well-being. The other side is when you switch from, you know, training 40 hours a week to nothing, there's huge chemistry changes that happen in your body that can also have an impact on your mental health. For someone that traveled and played with a team, and I'm thinking about some of the pro sport, like baseball or football, where, you know, you get to travel with your team all the time. Mm-hmm. You literally have no other social life. Or if you're being sent to a city that you don't know, your entire life is your team.
Yeah.
And then your next team will be your new life. So when that's over, you know, you don't necessarily have contact with former student from your school or even family members, I mean, that you've been out of touch for a while. So, you know, emotional and social aspects are pretty important. Obviously, the finances, if you haven't thought or planned, or if you haven't had, if you don't have the education. I mean, I can go on forever.
That's
specifically for the Olympian. I think there are many aspects that are similar that I just mentioned. The one that's interesting is you typically retire after an Olympic cycle. So every 4 years, you see a big wave of athlete mm-hmm. retirement. And that's pretty known as like the Olympic blues. So the athletes would like feel the Olympic blues after the games because, you know, you've been working for this for 20 years. Your cycle is 4 years, so you typically have a 4-year season. And then you peak at the biggest event the world can see with 10,000 people around you, you know, 3 weeks of event, it's a pretty big deal. And when you come back, I think a lot of athletes feel like, I mean, I remember coming back from my first Olympic game, I thought that everybody was short, fat, and unattractive. And that life was so boring. You know, when I went from like the highest excitement of my life at 20 years old, you literally like sitting on the couch wondering what was going on and being so tired that you don't really want to do anything, but you also know at the same time that it's so bad for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here you are podcasting with two guys that are short, fat, and unattractive. So, you know.
It's true. Life I'm not fat. I'm short and unattractive, but not fat. So
I'm fat.
Got that going for me. Yep. It's a dad bod. Okay. It's a dad bod.
Yeah.
To follow up on Brett's question, are there enough, I mean, this gets at what your organization's doing, but are there enough programs, organizations, people, coaches out there to support and address some of the issues that you've mm-hmm. identified?
I think there's a growing number of organizations, and it's really exciting. I mean, especially in the last year and a half, there's been a lot of former athletes starting to work in that space, individual coaches. I think the sporting organization do not have a choice anymore. They have to address some of those challenges. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there is more and more support. I think the challenge is to get athletes to actually seek support or recognize, because it's not a topic that has been talked about a lot. I don't think that athletes even know when to recognize to search for help or ask for help. So I guess that would be the next step for me to consider. And also, that shouldn't be a conversation that we're having afterwards. I mean, I would really like for sporting organization to invest heavily in, helping athletes develop outside of sport, helping them be more well-rounded, more balanced, understanding what identity means, what their identity is, understanding that sport is only a vehicle that they're using at that moment in time, but they will have other things during their life, so that they have some perspective, because otherwise, we're always going to be playing this catch-up of trying to help afterward, and, it could be so much easier if we did a little bit of work beforehand. And it's not going to work for everybody. Not everybody wants to be thinking about retirement. But without thinking about it, that can help just being more well-rounded or just having some fun outside of your sport is really going to help just be better prepared and even impact positively, I think, on your performance with areas of just thinking about something else and gaining some perspective rather than being totally brewing on your day. I mean, you guys know, this is something that the higher you go, the harder it gets. The pressure is really intense, especially in the pro sport. I mean, the difference between these athletes is nothing, literally. And it's really the mental game. And if you're brewing on everything every night after practice, it's easy to get into that vicious, vicious spiral, really.
Yeah.
So I think, having interest outside of sport helps with that as well.
Yeah. Those are great, mm-hmm. really great points. And hopefully, to your point, the organizations, professional organizations will take note and say, we realize our athletes need some of these resources kind of before it gets to that point where they're actually retiring. So where does your organization, Athlete Soul, fit into this picture that you're painting for these resources that athletes have?
So we're a nonprofit organization. We were started a year ago. We're really sort of a boutique service, I guess, for athletes. And the way we look at it is we are on a peer level. So we were formed by a former athlete. We are led by a former athlete. We're independent from the sporting organization. So we're trying to not take advantage of these athletes or their brand, but really be there to help as much as they need and offer our services for as little as possible. We have a system of financial aid as well. So most of the education content that we offer is for free. The coaching services, there is a cost attached to that, but that's where we offer financial aid. And we want to help from a holistic perspective. So it's really looking at all aspects of the transition raising awareness before those athletes are retired, getting them better prepared, getting that message out that, you need to develop outside of your sport, helping them through the transition. And then actually we've had quite a lot of former athletes support the organization, because this is something that they face themselves and they, they can relate to the cause. So we've started doing a fair bit of networking as well between our former athlete and current retiring athlete.
So you work, it's not just synchronized swimmers, but you work with athletes from different disciplines. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. We have, so basically anybody that has challenges with athletic retirement,
yeah.
Wherever they are, if they're, it could be high school student, it could be college student, a student athlete, pros, Olympian, really, if you spend a certain amount of time in life and your young life, you know, dedicated to your sport, you're probably going to have challenges with identity crisis in figuring out what's next. And so, you know, we're happy to help. It's more about someone that fits with, you know, what we're advocating for rather than a sport specifically. So any sport.
Have you noticed differences in athletes depending on the sport that they played? Do you feel that athletes from, you know, certain sports are maybe more or less prepared for retirement, or is everybody kind of on the same wavelength?
This is actually a question I get fairly often, and I don't really think there are a lot of differences between the athlete, even between one country and another. You would think that culturally there's more differences, but I don't think that's actually the case. I feel that athletes face similar, they all face an identity crisis for sure. Often there are financial issues, definitely social inadequacies in some areas. I feel like the criteria that are more important is how you ended your career, you know, if you chose or not, if you had an injury or not. And also what type of environment you have around you. You have parents and family that encourage you to do a lot more things than just your sport. If you continued your education with a purpose of a professional career in mind, not necessarily just to fit the box of education, I think you're more equipped. Doesn't mean it's going to be easier, but you're better equipped for the transition. But I think just having people around you that recognize your worth outside of your athletic performance, I think that's a huge, huge element.
Yeah.
And it feels, you know, that if they're not valued outside of their athletic performance, then I think it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. You've given us a lot of knowledge today. This has been... First of all, I don't think I'm going to see synchronized swimming the same way. I love how you basically said it's four sports in one. You mentioned that it's weightlifting and it's dance and it's gymnastics and it's swimming. I think that's tremendous. I never really thought about it that way. And I think it's great for Ben and I, and hopefully it's enlightening for those that, you know, listen and watch to this episode. And I think your organization also is pretty unique, and I think very sadly it is unique because I don't think a lot of people understand what you've mentioned, which is this idea of identity and what a lot of people face at the end of their, you know, their work career, which is who am I now and where am I going? And I love how you, you encapsulate that with Athlete Soul and saying that we are working on this, you know, this holistic healing effort. We talked about this offline, but it's been a theme recently with a lot of the great guests that we've had on the show about health and about wellness.
Yeah.
So it's great to have you on. It's great for you to be doing this. And we're really thankful to have you here. And so let's say that there is a professional athlete who's either watched or listened to this or knows somebody who's a professional athlete and is retiring. Where can they find you or where can they find out more about Athlete Soul?
So they can find us on our website. It's www.athletesoul.space. There's tons of information already on the website that's available without even for them like reaching out. My contact information is also on the website, so they can email if they want further support. But the website, I think, is a great place to start because they can already do some work without, you know. I know it's difficult for athletes to reach out, so I think that's it's a good first step.
Yeah. Okay. And on Instagram at Athlete Soul.
Yep. Absolutely.
Please rate and subscribe where applicable. Thanks as always to our editing team for putting together today's show. You can find us on Twitter at @HeadGamePsych. You can find me on Twitter at @DrBetLevine. And you can find that guy on Twitter at @BD Rosenberg PhD. And thanks as always for tuning in.